I am Jeff Tom, and President of the California Council of the Blind, and I hereby call to order the first general session of the 2016 Convention of the California Council of the Blind. All right. And we are live streamed out to ACB Radio Land. It's my understanding anyway. And I want to thank the team, Louie and his team, for their work in live streaming us. We're going to begin with our Pledge of Allegiance today by the president of the San Diego Braille Club chapter, Patricia Bogard. Pat? Go ahead. I'll give you this mic out of the mic stand.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. If everyone will please stand and look for the flag in your heart, as there seems to be absent. Okay, if you'll please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
Okay, do we have our Viejas band of Kumeyaay Indians here yet? Apparently we don't have them yet. Oh, they are coming, okay. Thanks, Charlene. We're going to let them make their way up. As they're making their way up, I'll do a few announcements. Let's see. Okay. First, we have plenty more tickets for meals for tomorrow, and I think even President's Dinner tickets. We strongly encourage and hope that you will support our events. You know, hotels like to hear that we do well and support our plated meals, and the food here has been wonderful. So, yes, yes. Okay, so you tell me when you have all your people up here. Okay, a couple more announcements. At 3:30 today, just like yesterday, but for those of you who weren't here yesterday, at 3:30 today, across the street, there will be if Peter or someone who's in here can go to exhibits and let them know in there as well, there will be fireworks and a helicopter across the street, and it's pretty cool sounding, but it may not be so cool for the dogs, so we do want to apprise people of that. It's a practice for some event that they're going to be holding. I wish I was going to be here for the event. But it is loud enough to hear. And so we want for the guide dog handlers especially. Yeah, I might as well do that now. As I said, we're out there in ACB Radio Land. And there is one person who I have a feeling is listening, who we miss incredibly at this convention. And this is the first one that he has had to miss since in more than 15 years. I don't have the exact number of conventions, but an awful lot of conventions. We know that that due to some medical things, we've had to miss this time our tremendous administrative assistant, and let's hear it for Ed Branch. He wanted me to know that he misses you just as much as you miss him, And that's got to be a lot, because I'll tell you, we miss having his organization here, organizational skills here, and all that, and we miss his just everything that he does for us. So we're all wishing him well, and he's wishing you, each and every one of us, well. So let's hear it one more time for Ed. Let's do a door prize. I don't know if Debbie is here yet, but if I don't know if she is. Do we have Debbie yet? Debbie, not unfortunately not you. Debbie Obregon. Although we're glad you're here, you don't have the door prize basket. and they do it at registration, so we will... get a note out to them. I think I should.
Any announcements?
Well, tell you what, let's. We still don't have the rest of your dancers yet. Virginia? Hold on.
Wait.
Hold on.
Wait.
Virginia? We still don't have the rest of your folks yet. You need a couple more minutes? Okay, you come up and tell me when you're ready.
Okay, well.
You ready?
I would think so. Okay, was he to do the.
The blessing? And yes, he's going to do whatever you guys decide to do. Okay. So I'm going to introduce to you, and she will introduce the rest of them, our hosts for the weekend in a large sense. The tribe. On which this reservation is derived, the Kumeyaay Band of Indians, and with us today to give us their blessing and for some bird singers and dancers, I'm going to introduce Virginia Chrisman to introduce the others. Virginia?
I will go ahead and do the blessing in my language. Okay, I will. Hello, I'm glad to see all of you here today. It's a beautiful thing when we all come together like this. Before we get started on anything, I'd like to introduce our bird singers here, Rel Chrisman, his wife Vanessa Chrisman, and sons, Jay Chrisman, Ryan Chrisman, daughter Reese and Rhiannon, and the little one is Ryder. But first, before they get started, we're going to do a blessing. So I'm going to do it in my language, and I would like you all to pray in your own way as well. Maya ha pil pi iu ye han malu malu ma mu ya chue khme pi wiu. Pi wawi u a cup mya pi to wipe uchu wea ka cup mya pi a matem. Nya ye han wo mulu ma mya kor pi pi u, bapi a pi u pi matem. Pil nya ye han ha hail mum, but ti han mya mulu mao to wei pi wi u, maya ha kia kapasho pi a to wei. Pil pi wi u han mya ma. Ask the Creator to bless each and every one of you as you came to you come here to our land. You welcome you here, and to socialize, be together as it is for one big family. And thank you for being here. Hey. Now this will be turned over to Ralph.
Hello, everyone. My name is Ral Chrisman, and I brought my family here, my wife and two daughters and three sons, and we're going to share for you guys a few of our bird songs. These songs, in our belief, were given to us in ancient times, and so we know that they're thousands of years old. They're very, very old, and it takes a long time to learn them. My whole entire life, I'm in my mid-30s, my whole entire life has been spent learning and now singing these songs, and my children now are also learning, and they'll spend their whole life learning them. My father is a singer of these songs, and that is how these songs have been transmitted from generations back to the present day. So lifelong endeavors, lifelong learning, and generation to generation. So ancient songs in our language, and it's a way for us to greet and also to bless one another. Our people tell us that at one point in our history, we were unable to get along with each other, and we had issues in having good times with one another. We had issues with communication with one another, and that these songs were given to us, and the simple beat that they have made us feel good. In modern day times, we say that you hear these songs and you're around them, you kind of tend to feel good anyways. It makes you feel good. It has a nice beat to it. The words talk about old stories, stories that guide us and how to behave ourselves and how to treat others in a good way. And so with that, generations and generations have sung these songs, and there's blessings in that, because I'm singing a song that somebody many, many generations ago sang, and it's an honor to do that. So that's where the blessings come from that. So I'll sing a few of them. In our language, we say halka, mimitamwa. And halka, if you were to break it down literally, it talks about the energy that's inside of a person. So when you welcome somebody, it's more than just saying hello or it's good to see you. It's more than that. It's actually taking energy within yourself and offering it to the person that you're greeting. To say halka is to say, hey, I'm here for you. I'm going to invest time and energy into your presence. And by them or the person saying halka back, they're also doing that. So in our way of thinking, we don't have a word for saying goodbye. The closest thing we have is nyawu or nyawum, which is saying at some point we will meet again. I'll see you again down the road at some point. There is no goodbye, because once that energy is kind of mingled together, it's always there. So in our worldview, even when we pass on, you will see that person again, but in the afterlife. You will be with that person. So that's a little bit about our beliefs, the way we greet one another, how we believe. And again, this is all very ancient to our people, very ancient to this land. We are San Diego's first people. We are the first people of this earth here. In our creation story, it says that we were literally made from the earth here, and that the Creator, our Creator, blew life inside of us. And that soul, when done on this planet, goes on into the universe. Some say even the Milky Way. So I hope you enjoy. I'm going to sing four songs, and my daughters and my wife will dance. That is part of the story of our journey in life and our journey here on this planet in this region. Some of these songs actually talk about our migrations from here and the local areas, some of the local landscape. And my sons here will help me sing, so I hope you enjoy.
Amen.
Thank you. I hope you guys have a good time here at Viejas. I hope you guys feel welcome and know that you are welcome. And I hope everything goes well for you today. So have a good day. Thank you. Yay, hun.
Back for you. Oh, yeah. Right up here. This was a truly wonderful experience. Thank you to Virginia. Thank you to the Chrisman family. Thank you to everyone for the blessings, the singing, and the dancing that you provided us. That's wonderful. Let's hear it one more time for them. You know, I think that, you know, Indians tend to be an underserved population in generally, and I think this is widely known by most of us in this room, and especially those with disabilities who are also Indians. As a double minority, it's easy to fall through the cracks for services and to get the services they need. So to discuss Indians with disabilities and also specifically those who are blind and vision impaired, I'm going to bring back Raul Chrisman to give us his particular perspective. Raul?
Hello again, everybody. A little bit about myself. I am an educator. That's where I am by, I guess, by nature, by occupation at least. I teach high school, geography, world history, really all the social sciences at a high school level. At a local public school in El Cajon at Granite Hills High School, we have somewhere near, upwards near 3,000 students beginning of the year, and then somewhere mid to 2,000 to 2,800, somewhere in there. By the end of the year, because, you know, kids do tend to change schools and whatnot. So it's a large school, public school. Also, I am the executive director for Kumeyaay Community College. It's a local college that deals with Kumeyaay classes, our culture and our heritage, and ultimately trying to get that knowledge to mainstream society. All those classes are through Kuyamaka College, a local junior college. All classes are accredited through, you know, through all the UC-CSU system. So I'm an educator. That's what I do. And on a tribal level, though, as you guys just heard, I'm a singer and a little bit of a storyteller. And I also have the privilege to work with a lot of our youth. My wife and I and my mother also, we are the cultural department here at Viejas. So we run our cultural program, all the programs for kids trying to educate about our ancient ways, our history, and to bring those to the modern time, to our modern era. And so that's what we do. When I was asked or approached to speak today, I was asked to kind of speak on disability in general, also as it relates to cultural times and a history of that amongst our people and as it goes to modern day times and presently and services and all of these things. And when I was starting to talk about what I was going to speak about today, one thing, you know, it kind of hit very close to home, because at that moment, my mother was actually the one I was speaking earlier. She was in the process of getting some procedures done to her eyes. She had extreme cataracts where she was having very much difficulty to see. She wasn't able to drive. I think at one point she told me it felt like it was raining. She couldn't see, so she had to stop driving, and it was getting progressively worse. So she got one eye procedure done, and then she went back and finally got the other eye done. And so that's very recent. She just had that done, and she's still dealing with, very much with the with light and things like that that are hurting her vision. But I kind of joked, and my family kind of joked with my mom around that time, because growing up, she'd always told us about her grandfather. And so that would be my great-great-grandfather, generations back. And this is a time period that it was very much pre-contact style of living still here in San Diego. At one point, when the Spanish came in, and then later the Mexican period, and then the American periods, they took over San Diego County near the coastlines. Inland out here in Alpine and El Cajon, these inland areas of San Diego, they're very much rural. And so they didn't really venture in until the mid-1800s, late 1800s. And so when they did come in, one of the first things they wanted to do was get a census. They wanted to get a census of who's living there, who's in a village. And so the very first tribal enrollment that we still go by today, who's part of the tribe, were those individuals who wrote their name down and said, we're part of this tribe, my kids are so-and-so. So this gentleman, if I trace my family tree back with written word, he is the very first person on my mom's side to have written his name down. He is the first of my family going way back. So that's how long ago I'm talking. We're talking late 1800s. But he was known in my family. My mom always would say, oh, the old blind man, because that's what he was. He was very much blind. He could not see. And we've always been raised with the knowledge of this old blind man. Because while he couldn't see with his eyes, he had great insight and he had great sight. And now as an adult, working with children who sometimes have difficulties and disabilities with hearing or vision in a public setting, the public school setting, I think back to my great-grandfather and his lifestyle versus the more contemporary lifestyle. And sadly, I think in a traditional setting, we tended to respect a person like my great-grandfather a lot more than we do in modern times, frankly. In his time period, the elderly in general were very much respected. They were a resource. Modern day times, it's very difficult for elderly sometimes, because their knowledge is that of wisdom. Their knowledge is that of experience. They've experienced things. They've had, they know, you know, that they really are in the know, not in the in the practical sense, but not in the necessarily in the hypothetical sense, whereas the younger generations tend to think they know. You know, it's all very hypothetical knowledge. They hear a movie, you know, they hear the song, they see, you know, a movie, or they experience the internet, and the internet's got answers for everything. So they think they know everything. And dealing with kids, high school level, I can tell you that that is the number one issue facing kids today. They think they know everything. And that's probably always been an issue. I am young myself, and I tend to think I know a lot sometimes, so I am guilty by my own admission. But in the older, more traditional social way of being for our Kumeyaay tribe, the elderly were a resource. We did not have Google. We didn't have internet. So if you needed to know something and you didn't know it, there was only one browser to go find, if you will, and that was, can I go find someone who's experienced it, who's done it before? And so you would go find the older person. And so because of that, everybody in the village had a role. Young people had a role. That was to help out the older people. That was to do a lot of the menial work. In our culture, we eat acorns. They fall off the oak tree. They're small little, they're small nuts that we'd grind up, make a flour out of. They're actually toxic if you just eat them raw, but we would leach them. But it's kind of a pain to pick those things up, so you would have all the little kids do that, and they'd make a game out of it and have fun. Whereas an older person might hurt their back doing that all day. So everybody in the village had somewhat of a responsibility, a need. And for the young kids, it was those kind of tasks. For an older person, they were essentially the internet. They were that information base. They were that wisdom. When the people making decisions needed to make a decision that was very impactful for the tribe, especially generations forward, it was to go to the older people. Ask them, is this a good decision? Do you think it's a good decision? And with your experience, what are some of the pitfalls that we're going to have with generations to come? And it was up to those leaders to make decisions. And this is something that nowadays, too, we have a lot of issues with, is we like to make decisions for now, as opposed to, can I make a decision that's going to last 3-4 generations? And our old philosophy was that if you made a decision as a leader, it was to stick 4 or 5 generations. You're making decisions not for now, but for your great-great-grandkids. So decisions that my great-grandfather made, I am today living whatever decisions they made, good or bad. I'm still living in that. So everybody had their place. And for my great-grandfather, who was blind, he also had his place. He could not see, but that didn't mean that he didn't have sight. He didn't have foresight. He didn't have insight into decisions that needed to be made. He had a purpose. Until his dying day, he had a deep purpose. One of the stories that my mom shared with us was that he had a vision come to him. And in that vision, he said that he didn't understand it at the time. Again, this is a long, long time ago, but he said he had a vision that the city, which in San Diego at the time, East County was very rural, all fields, mountainous areas, not a lot of houses. On the Viejas Reservation here, early in the 30s even, there was only a dozen houses, not much civilization, if you will, out here. A lot of civilized people, just not a lot of buildings. But he had a vision that the city, he said, was going to come from the south. And he said, not from the north, the east, or the west, but in this village here, in this reservation, the city would come from the south. This was an insight that he had that was given to him. In our traditional way, we would say that this was a spiritual vision given to him, that he was seeing a premonition of sort. For whatever came to him and why it came to him, he said that. He said, the city will come from the south. Now, you skip ahead really 100 years now, and that foresight that he saw is absolutely true. And that if we look at where in our community has the population poured in, where are their buildings, where is there a lot going on, it is on the southern side of our valley. On the eastern and western sides, those are protected lands. No one lives there. They were not protected at the time. But maybe he, knowing his history of the region, knew that those would be protected at one point. I don't know. No one knew at that time. But through the south, we have our casino. We have our outlet center here. To the south, the freeway was built in the 60s. The freeway is built to what it is today. Homes on the other side of the freeway. The city has come into our valley, but it has come from the south, as he said. Some people would say, oh my God, that's a crazy premonition. But what it was is that he knew his valley, he knew the landscape, he knew things, histories of this land that he probably had a little bit of insight that a lot of people didn't have. And he had that without having vision, physical vision. Another thing that came to him at one point was he said he didn't understand it, but there was going to be a home that would be brought in. It would be brought in, built already in, on wheels and placed in the middle of the reservation. And at that point, you're talking, like I said, the 100 years ago. You know, what is he saying? There's going to be a house already built, brought in on wheels. What does this mean? Well, modern day times, we know of mobile homes, but he didn't speak of a mobile home. He spoke of something permanent and be brought in and put down. Well, years and years, decades later, there would be homes brought into this community, and those houses would be those modular homes, and they are truly put together and brought in on wheels. And, you know, he knew at that point that that would be the way of the future for a lot of homes in this valley. Traditionally, our people built homes with their own hands. They gathered their materials, and they built them as a family. And then when they deceased, they would burn the whole home down. And when times changed, history changed, they couldn't do that no longer. They couldn't gather their own home stuff. So homes were built with, you know, the brick and mortar or with sticks. They were built, you know, with lumber, and they were on cement. They weren't some homes you can move and burn down and recreate. So this idea that he had that we would go back at one point to homes that were not stationary, really a crazy idea, if you ask me. If I was in that time period, I would say, man, this guy's crazy. This old blind man's crazy. But he really had insight into the future. Beyond that, he had all kinds of insight into dreams, into things that come to people as another sense, if you will, come to people in their sleep and at different times during the day when they zone out, these dream interpretations. And psychologists after Freud have these, you know, these, they say dreams mean something. They definitely mean something, and they tap into your prior experiences. They tap into things that maybe are bothering you, and that's why we have these dreams. And I think we've all had something come to us, ideas or dreams, and you wonder, what does it mean? Why are we dreaming that? Well, tribal people around the globe have also had their interpretation of dream and dream analysis, and what does it mean? Most often than not, I see it written in a book, and that doesn't mean much of anything. It's very anecdotal. It's fun, like, oh, you had a dream. That means this. This means that. But some people truly had dream analysis to a T. A lot of this might take generations to gather that knowledge, because if you dream something, it might be years and years until you dream it again. And if that dream means something, it might be years and years again until you catch what that dream means. And at which point you would notice that I dreamt this, or I had this vision come to me, and this event happened, or it was after this event. And so you would tell people, years later it happened again, years later, and maybe a lifetime later, happened again. And so for generations of life, people gathered that knowledge and were able to create some type of understanding of dream analysis. Well, my great-grandfather was also one of those people. He was a person that you could explain your dreams to, and he would tell you what it meant to your life and things that are probably going to happen to the community and to that person. And the people, especially his family, trusted that information as accurate knowledge. It was not anecdotal. It was not like, oh, this might happen, or this is very interesting. Let me put this in the end of the newspaper. This was information they took to heart as fact. And so this individual, not having any eyesight, was a very, very important part of his family, key role in his family, very, very important part with of his community, great attributes. Even though he could not see, he had he was the Google of his community at that time. He was somebody you would go and ask. And even though he lacked one sense, he had other senses that and really the sense of experience, really, you know, that ability to have lived a long, long life. He was a very old man, and to be able to share. And a reason why I think of that, and I sometimes will think of this story along with others and share with people of all walks of life, is because it's a reminder that we all have something to give. We all have something to offer somebody somewhere. And I think no matter who you are, age or disability, sometimes we forget that, you know. And even if you don't consider yourself disabled, whatnot, we kind of sometimes can forget that. Like I said, I work with high school kids. And sometimes high school kids will think that. They don't offer anything to anybody. They get very much depressed. They get down on themselves. They don't understand what they offer. And sometimes it takes a lifetime to really understand and appreciate what you have to offer. And so I think he found his niche. He's seen where he could offer a lot to his people, and they respected that. And so he had his place in society. And definitely he had to make accommodations for himself, and others had to work with him. And so that's really what is key, right, is the respect that you would give another person, and then trying to find a way to accommodate that person as part of the community. And that's why I say traditionally, we did a very good job, our tribe, of doing that, to accommodate people who were disabled, elderly, or just flat out different. In modern day times, the populations have increased, a lot of things have become very mainstreamed, and it is very difficult to sometimes find these accommodations. But I always urge my students who have disabilities to don't give up in the human essence of everything, the communication with other people. We are here essentially to help each other. Going back thousands of years, they say we've been on this planet 2 million years close to. Something that was human-ish has been here 2 million years on this planet. And if you go way back into that history, there is no way we as humans would have survived by ourselves. We have to go out and in search of others and try to help each other out. And our culture made a culture out of that, of helping each other out and trying to look for ways that people can contribute to the community. And then we ourselves also, how can we contribute to a community? I don't know if I've got too far off course, to be honest, with what I'm speaking of today. I would like to maybe ask if anybody has any questions. That might be a good way, because I know we're all here for different reasons, and questions sometimes open that door. So I see a question. I can't read your name from here.
Can we try to get a mic to the questioner?
If someone can run a mic, that would make my job easier, because I don't know everybody in this room. I would like to know you all. And in some small way, I feel like I know you already, because we spent some time now. I know you guys know me, so that's always a good thing, I guess.
Well, when I was curious about,
yes.
What's the migration of your tribe like? Where did it come from? Did it come from Mexico, or did it come from Arizona, or come down from California and settle here, like that?
Thank you. Great question. I spoke earlier about, I said some of those songs talk about our migration. We, as Kumeyaay, are from here in San Diego. We believe that we were created right here from this earth, that our creator sculpted us in a similar way that we create our pottery, with the mud and then fired, and then they said breathed life into us. That being said, we have a very long historical record on this planet here. You go out towards the east of where we're at right now, past the mountains, you drop into a desert. There's the Salton Sea out there. It has not always been like that. Right now, it's a very dry, hot spot. It doesn't look like anybody would really want to live there, per se. But 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, it was an area that looked much like, was much like Lake Tahoe, and there was a large lake there, Lake Kaweah. It's a historic lake. It's since dried up, gone away, and come back as the Salton Sea. And so our tribe was once on the banks of that lake there. And so if you go out there, there's to this day artifacts all out there. Some of those things date 4,000, 5,000. There's artifacts that sit right on top of the dirt that are 7,000, 8,000 years old. Archaeologists say they know for certainty that we've been here at least 13,000 years. If you go out to the ocean of San Diego, down in La Jolla Shores, beautiful area down there, nice breeze, it's a nice cove. If you went back 10,000 years ago, that water level was lower to about 25 feet lower, in some areas all the way down to 50 feet lower than what it is today. Great amount of distance, right, for water to go up and down when we're talking about the ocean. The ocean's huge. So the way we know that it's out, or that we've been here, is that we have always claimed that there are that there's villages under the ocean out there. We said there's villages out there under the ocean, and they're out there. Our people used to live out there. It's in our oral history. Archaeologists and marine archaeologists especially kind of thought we were crazy for a long period of time. It wasn't until we really started drilling scientists started drilling into the cores of the South Pole, Antarctica. When they started to really have the understanding of the ice ages, that they realized that, well, it is possible that the water level could have been low enough to have villages out there, but that would have been 10,000 years ago, because that's when the ice age came, the last ice age. And sure enough, in the last 50 years, there's been people, archaeologists, that have gone out there and they have scuba dived that area, and they've found our ancient villages that we've always claimed that were out there. So we know that there's villages out there. We don't really tell everybody where they're at because we don't want people to loot them. But if you go out to La Jolla Shores, there's a nice little monument out there that is dedicated to that village that explains to people that there's a Kumeyaay village out there, and that it was from the last ice age, and that would have been 10, 13,000 years ago. So our trace on this part of the world is very, very ancient. Archaeologists give us up to, some give us all the way up to 30,000 years, they said, we've been here. Linguistically, our language is one of the oldest in all of the Americas. We're part of the Yukon, our Yuman-Hokan language grouping. There's other tribes that are similar to ours, but they say that language branch is one of the oldest in all of the Americas. And so we are, if it is true that we at some point came here from Asia or somewhere like that, that we would have been one of the first groups to have done that. But again, we always assert that we have always been here since the creation of humanity. We don't say that people didn't start off other places. We just say that we started off here. Some people may have migrated. Our songs and stories talk about migrations from here to the Grand Canyon and back around the whole region, really. So eastern Arizona, very far south, western Nevada, and then southern California, and then on down into Mexico, northern Baja California, north of the Sea of Cortez. All of this region is where our stories talk about the physical landscape there, mountain peaks and waterways and things of that nature. So that's the region that we've been walking around for the last 30,000 years. And so that's what we talk about with our migrations. And more locally, though, in the last 10,000 years, we would migrate from the mountains to the beach if it got really, really cold. If there was a really, really dry couple years, people would migrate from dry areas to areas where there's a lot more moisture and water. Here in Viejas, there's a wetland in the middle of the reservation. It's not very visible anymore because we've been so dry. Hopefully El Nino fills it back up. But even in the driest month of August, you could go down there and there's still water. You can still get water down there. So it is a true wetland by definition. So I hope I answered the question. More questions? Or?
We have time for one more.
Time for one more. Yes, ma'am, in the front here. I can't read your name. We got a mic coming over to you, though.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Berman. And I guess what I want to know is, the education system for this area, it's a large area, so I'm not sure about the school districts and stuff like that, but as a tribe, you guys have a huge input to what goes on around here. Do you have, like, authorized special resources for disabled kids who are coming up, because they do need a little more as far as education, the technology, Braille, just all kinds of things. And I just wondered if you could maybe give me some information about that. Do you have schools on the res, or do they just do whatever the public schools are? Do you bus the kids out to somewhere else? And if there are good resources for, well, blind children.
Thank you. Great question. If you couldn't hear, the question was about the resources for our school-age children. Here on the reservation, we have approximately 120, from this reservation of Viejas, about 120 students from the age, you know, from high school on down to kindergarten. And for the most part, the majority of those kids bus into the local school districts, public school system in Alpine for the lower levels. And then for high school, they go down to El Cajon, where I teach at Granite Hills. There's a few that go to the neighboring school in the same district, but they all go to the public school. That being said, there are, on a tribal level, if they're from this reservation, Viejas has set up opportunities for our own tribal members to have health care, and they provide services for those kids that have really all disabilities. And I think in our tribe we have a decent number of disabled children for different reasons. But the tribe does step up and provide them services. Above and beyond that, or if a child is Native American, federally recognized, and they don't have, and they're not from this reservation, they're from maybe a neighboring reservation who does not have economic development, meaning they don't have financial abilities, through the federal government, there is the Southern Indian Health Council. They're federally funded, and they're down the street, actually, from where we're at right now. And they have services also, and they do a pretty decent job of outreach and going into the neighboring, into the reservations and different events and getting to know the community. And if there are kids who are disabled for being impaired for vision or hearing or really any disability, they will go into the home and meet with them and try to best meet their needs. That being said, if a student is a Native American student, federally recognized, whether they're part of a gaming tribe or not, and they're in the public school district, there are Title IX funds that go for that student. So every Native student in the United States that's in a public school, any student, really, any student in a public school, the federal government gives money for them to be at school every day. That's how teachers get paid and all of that kind of stuff. Native American students, through Title IX funds, they receive nearly twice the amount of funding for that school as do regular non-Native American students. And it used to be Title V funds, now it's Title IX. And part of that Title IX funding is for disabled kids. So if you're a family and your son or daughter is going to a school, in a public school, and they're Native American and disabled, and it doesn't matter the disability, that school receives nearly three times the funding than an average student at that school. So at which point, usually schools in our district, we as Native Americans, we get very active, and we ask that they have a site rep that addresses the needs of the Native Americans. We have a general election for a Native American parent to sit on the education board committee and to make sure that if there are kids or families that have needs, that they can address those needs, that they don't fall through the crack. Because what happens is sometimes schools get that money, and then if the parents or the family don't speak up or they don't have an advocate, they don't have a 504 advocate that's kind of mouthy, you know, willing to stand up, or they don't have a tribal representative, then that kid might get similar services to every other kid while that school is getting paid three times the monetary funding. So the money is there on a federal level. Often the funding is there for a tribal level. And so if you know kids that are like that or in that situation, make sure you tell their families to speak up. There should be an on-site person, an on-site advocate at the school level to endorse and promote their 504, which is what a kid is given, a 504 plan, which addresses their disability in the school, public school system. And there should be, if they're near a Native population, there should be a Native American council or parent group or some kind of system set up to advocate for those kids also. And if not, the school goes straight to the principal because they know they're getting that money and they really need to spend it where it needs to go to help those kids. I hope I answered your question a little bit. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I hope you guys have a good time.
Well, let's hear another hand for Raul Crispin and the whole group. What a unique perspective we've been given today.
Thank you.
Very pleased to meet you. So, almost dumped the microphone, everyone. That would have been interesting. Okay, we're going to do a door prize, and then while we're doing that, can we get a microphone out to Pamology? So we'll get you your report as soon as we do a door prize. So do we have Debbie in the room? Okay, hey Mitch, are you in the audience? Do you remember when we had, at one of your conventions, Debbie Door Prize? Well, now we have our own Debbie Door Prize. Debbie Obregon. So, she is graciously helping us out today. And the first door prize will be $25 from Glendale Burbank plus. We're going to give a big whopping $50 door prize to start. $25 from Orange County and $25 from Glendale Burbank. So, aren't you glad you're here? Yeah, okay. And we're going to draw here. Debbie, go ahead. And if we need help with reading, we'll get Brooks or Ronnie to read the winning name. You can bet I'm not going to be able to read it. That's one thing we know. Brooks, can you help her with the reading of the name there? All right. You don't. I have the Glendale Burbank. I have the Glendale Burbank.
And then what else are we looking for?
We have to draw a name in Orange County. We have to draw a name. We're getting it together here. We'll go more smoothly as we move along. Besides, it makes the suspense all the greater.
Let me see. Man, I can't. The handwriting's not the best. I think it says something Calhoun, Eric Calhoun.
Eric Calhoun, are you here? Whoa, $50. There's half of it. Yeah, that's 25. So the Orange County is from as well. All right, that's our first door prize. We'll now turn it over to Pam Pology for the nominating committee report.
Thank you.
Yes, he's going to talk right now as soon as we're done.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate that. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Can you guys hear me all right? Thank you. Okay, the nominating slate got together, and I want to thank them for their, the nominating committee got together. I want to thank them for their patience because we had a lack of Braille writer crisis, and they had to wait until a Braille writer appeared, and no one said, hey, you need to get with the times and get with technology. So thank you. So here we go. The nominating committee has placed forth the name of Judy Wilkinson for president, the name of Frank Welty for first vice president, the name of Peter Pardini for treasurer, and as I go to the board of directors, I want to make one notation that Vincent Cabron's term, he is termed out now, so if you don't hear his name, don't start any rumors. Okay, so board of directors we have Paul Patchy Jr., Charlene Ornelas, Pat Bogard, and Gail Crossan. I want to congratulate them, and remember that tonight anyone can nominate from the floor, and again, I want to thank my committee for all their help and for working so hard and so late. Thank you so very much.
Okay, thank you. We'll talk a little more about this, but we're going to move along because one of our speakers has a time constraint. I'm going to, do you want to go ahead? Okay. We are very honored today to have Christopher Murphy with us. Christopher is with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Region 9 in our region. He's up in Sacramento. And he's going to be discussing one of the most fascinating topics to come before our membership in years and years and years, judging by everybody that talks to me about it. And that is automated vehicle research activity or driverless vehicles. Without given that we have a short period of time, I don't want to take up any more of his time by an introduction. I want to bring Christopher on right now. Christopher?
Thank you, Mr. President. On behalf of our administrator, Dr. Mark Rosekind, we're thrilled to be invited. I want to thank the committee for the invitation also. As the president mentioned, this issue is near and dear to you and to everyone. It's in the news, it seems like, almost every day. And I have some information from our headquarters. This is the latest and greatest information. Your conference committee, Gene Lozano, had asked me to cover some questions, actually some answers to some questions that you had, and to the extent possible, I will attempt to answer those various questions. And these were posed to the experts at our headquarters in D.C. I am not an expert, but I have the information from the experts. So it's kind of exciting that this is the most up-to-date information that is available. So with that being said, I'd like to go over a few things. And it's kind of interesting going over this information. I learned a ton. So, one of the things we talk about, what is vehicle automation? And there's different terms that are being used: automated vehicles, autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars, driverless cars, unmanned, etc. To us, the term automated vehicles really refers to the full spectrum, and that's kind of the term that we seem to be going with. At the lower levels of automation, drivers maintain the full dynamic driving task, but automation augments their role. An example is automatic emergency braking, or AEB. Drivers operate the vehicle full time, and AEB engages when it becomes necessary. At the highest levels of automation, there is no longer a driver, or even in some concepts, driver controls. Software and algorithms replace the complete role of the driver. When we look at some of the safety enhancements, we know, and I think most people know, but don't really talk about, that over 90% of police reported crashes involve some type of driver error. It really is about the driver and them making the error that causes, like I said, 90 to 94% of all fatal crashes. When we look at the safety benefit and the potential, our data indicates that our safety benefits for driver-assisted systems, such as smart technologies. NHTSA research is doing our best to quantify potential safety impacts that are currently underway. On May 2015, Secretary Fox, UST DOT Secretary, he said two things. He said the department wants to speed the nation toward an era where vehicle safety just isn't about surviving crashes, it's about avoiding them. Connected, automated vehicles that can sense the environment around them and communicate with other vehicles and with infrastructure have the potential to revolutionize road safety and save thousands of lives. On January 16th, which was about 3 months ago, because I guess we're in April, Secretary Fox had an announcement. He said NHTSA will deliver on four important milestones, and I want to touch on each of those. The first is using NHTSA's existing authorities to issue regulatory interpretations and exemptions to enable safety automation. NHTSA already received requests and issued interpretations to Google, BMW, and General Motors in this area, and our authority to issue limited exemptions from federal safety standards in the pursuit of safety innovation can be a powerful tool for enabling innovation. NHTSA The second is we're working on developing a plan of what new tools and authorities we might need to fulfill our safety mission in this new era. We recognize that the careful, complex, far from rapid processes of formal regulation aren't necessarily a great match for fast-moving tech advances. And so we're working to develop the framework we think can best align NHTSA's tools and authorities with the future that offers such great safety potential. The third is our work to issue operational guidance for the safe deployment of automated vehicles. This guidance will provide manufacturers and other stakeholders with guidelines of how NHTSA expects safe automated vehicles to behave in a variety of conditions. We expect to outline how data should be collected on the crash avoidance capabilities of automated vehicles and to include guidance not only on passenger vehicles, but on those designed for commercial goods and people transportation. Related to this initiative, NHTSA announced that we will hold two public meetings. Today in Washington is the first one. The second one will be in California sometime soon. We're doing these to gather input as we prepare this operational guidance, and we are eager to hear from the public and you about how we can provide the best guidance to ensure safe deployment and maximize safety potential. Our fourth effort is ongoing work with the states and the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators, AMVA, to develop model state policy on automated vehicles. Our goal here is to respond to the many states that have reached out to us for guidance in this area, as we want to help them develop policies that mesh with policies in their neighbor states and policy we at the federal level are developing so that we can have a uniform nationwide framework to help enable innovation. Our overall goal in all these efforts is to be nimble and to have a flexible framework that allows NHTSA to keep pace with the fast pace of transformation, the most significant tech leap in more than a century of automotive history. You know, last year, Secretary Fox asked NHTSA to examine its regulatory framework to determine where there may be obstacles to deploying safety-enhancing technologies. With the help of DOT's Intelligent Transportation Systems Joint Program Office, it's a mouthful, NHTSA turned to DOT's VOLPE National Transportation Systems Center. VOLPE responded with a report that looked at NHTSA's Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, the set of regulations that sets the baseline for vehicle safety on the roads. Any manufacturer seeking to produce vehicles for American drivers must certify that its vehicles comply with the FMVSS. And for decades, the evolution of these standards has been a crucial driver in the safety advances that have protected so many lives on our roads. But these standards, as valuable as they are, were written in an era which it was assumed that any motor vehicle had a human driver at the controls. Developed through federal rulemaking processes, these standards are, by design, not easy to change, and they could present some challenges for some of the emerging revolution in safety technology. There are two insights that really draw attention, and I want to touch on each of those. The first is that for traditional vehicle designs, those with driver controls and cabin designs we all grew up with, there are relatively few obstacles within the FMVSS to fully automate driving. This may surprise some who thought federal regulation was likely to be a high hurdle to deployment of self-driving vehicles, but it closely matches NHTSA's own analysis of the regulatory universe. The second key observation is that non-traditional vehicle designs, those conceived for an era in which the human driver is no longer a starting assumption may find some major obstacles to deployment from with FMVSS. I always struggle with that. I have no idea why. I've been doing this for years. This, too, was not terribly surprising to NHTSA, but it is extraordinarily helpful to have the careful and detailed third-party analysis as a roadmap for our future activities. I want to talk a little bit. The biggest thing about the automation focus is that safety has to be first. We have to do this safely. As mentioned before, we do not believe it is sufficient to aim for automated systems to be as good as humans, as they're responsible for 90 to 94% of all fatal crashes. We need to do better than that. But we also cannot wait for perfect conditions under all circumstances. Another challenge that lies ahead is the public acceptance side. People won't accept an automated car unless they know it won't crash because of a design error or cybersecurity vulnerability. We cannot simply shift errors from drivers to programmers and system developers. When we approach safety of an automated vehicle system, we must have two primary tracks of consideration. One refers to how well the technology addresses human driver weakness, more specifically, crashes that occur due to general inattention, such as caused by distraction, fatigue, and impaired driving. Automation has great potential to overcome these weaknesses that have been plaguing us forever. On the other track of consideration, we consider how the system can replicate the strengths of human drivers. That is, when they are fully attentive and not distracted. Humans are actually good drivers, considering the complexity of operating a complex machinery such as a modern car, and also considering the limited amount of training that is required for licensing. Once the functions of the driver starts getting implemented by software and algorithm, there is an emphasis in making sure there are no new major issues that are being introduced, such as, for example, cybersecurity vulnerabilities. Talk a little bit about research. NHTSA continues to do research across the full spectrum of automated vehicles. We have results from initial set of research coming in, and they're guiding our design of the next round of research projects. Two studies should be published soon. One is a study that investigated high-level safety principles by automation level, and a study on estimating the target crash populations for concept automated vehicle functions. Studies such as this provide great insight as to what the most safety beneficial applications are. Kind of the conclusions before I hit on a few questions that you have asked us is vehicle innovation is here to stay. I think we all know that. It's just we want to make sure that safety is number one. NHTSA is working diligently to enable life-saving technologies to be safely deployed. And we welcome broad stakeholder input to our transparent process. As I mentioned, we had our first public hearing in D.C. today, and our second one will be here in California soon. And one thing we want to do is to remind folks they can still submit relevant documents to the open docket, which is NHTSA 2016-0036. And I know many of you are well aware of that. Now, I'd like to just touch on some of the questions. I've answered some of the questions that you've asked, but I thought I would touch on a few more things. What have we learned from road testing? We have 12 companies registered in California who have received permits to road test. Google reports that as of February 2016, they have 56 prototypes on the roads, primarily at two occasions, at two locations, one in Mountain View in California, the other one in Austin, Texas. Google also reports they have logged 1.5 million miles in autonomous mode with these cars. Now, Delphi reported that they completed a coast-to-coast trip in autonomous mode 98% of the time with their concept. While there have been significant testing taking place, these tests have been primarily performed in the hands of the developers. As NHTSA, we have been actively trying to find systems that we can test, but so far we have not been able to find one. This is not unreasonable considering the complexity of developing systems that are expected to do everything a human driver does well. While the motivation is primarily to overcome the weakness of human drivers, more specifically distraction and fatigue, the challenges associated with replicating the strengths of human drivers cannot be overlooked. You know, we look at the crash and the injury data, and we have been studying the safety enhancement potential for the different automation concepts. And we've developed a framework to parse all crashes and map them to operational principles and domains of concept of vehicle automation functions. In general, while the top level potential is 94% or more for improvement, many of the intermediate automation steps have more gradual improvement potential. For example, a concept that offers driverless valet parking at low speeds off of highways has a different safety enhancement potential than a system that can automate cars in a geographically bound area at low speeds and only in good weather, and similarly different than a system that can handle highway speed automation. You know, I kind of touched on public opinion, but it's so important. I mean, it's really highly variant. Some segments continue to see this as a major new risk area. Some other segments focus on the opportunities they offer and are more optimistic. The media, I think this is so true, and I think we all see it from time to time, is interested in the topic and any incidents associated with an automated vehicle that is being tested makes front page news. This is regardless of the severity and even in cases where they get struck by other cars. Even the non-event of two automated vehicles from different manufacturers getting close made the news, even though there was no real incident. Public opinion is mostly based on concepts and what people hear in the media. One of the questions was, what's the status of collaborative talks between computer technology and automobile producers? You know, the areas of artificial intelligence typically result in collaboration with robotics experts, and that is happening. The area of cybersecurity calls for collaboration across all domains. This is very, very important. These include computer tech companies, but due to the cyber physical nature of cars, there are stronger analogies in industries such as aviation, railways, medical devices, and nuclear plants. You know, we talk about one of the questions, what are some of the investments into the research and development of autonomous vehicles? Well, they're significant, and the private contribution is also significant. Both from traditional automakers, such as GM's purchase of Cruise Automation, Hyundai Kia's recent announcement of investment of more than $1 billion, Ford and Toyota's investment in conjunction with universities such as MIT, Stanford, and Delphi's investment, and non-traditional players, as we all know, we've all heard of the Google car, and also Uber. And President Obama, and I think many folks have heard this, he has proposed a 10-year, $3.9 billion investment to enable safe deployment of these safety systems. You know, what is the potential of autonomous cars being hacked? You know, cybersecurity risks are already prevalent in the current generation of vehicles. But there's a significant amount of research currently being done. These approaches will apply to highly automated vehicles, but they may not be sufficient. There is still much research that needs to be done. Whether there are potential incremental cybersecurity requirements that may arise from the removal of the human driver role at the highest levels of automation. Usually, a human driver can serve as the last resort protection. Just have a couple more questions. You know, policy implications in terms of travel behavior, urban sprawl, and legislation. You know, policy implications are broad, and I think we all realize that. And they're various. And I can tell you that there's other public entities that are also focusing on different aspects of potential impacts. Our focus is on the vehicle regulation and safety standard sides. We will work with other groups, all groups, your group, to stay abreast of their research in those areas as well. Finally, you know, one of the things we talk about is, you know, the future transport systems. You know, what's new with that? I think once again, our focus is to enable deployment of safer vehicle technologies and support transformative changes that can lead to significant lives saved. It's easy to foresee many transportation and service models that could emerge over time. I think that gives me and you an update as real time, as of about a week ago, as to where NHTSA is with automated vehicles. And we know it's very important to Americans. It's, I think, even more important in certain aspects to you, and we're very interested in hearing from the council and similar groups about the safety of automated technology. And we encourage you, Mr. President, to be vocal, and we want to hear from you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, we go. Thank you very much. We have time for one question. Do you have time for that, Chris?
I don't have to go anywhere. The problem is, there's probably most questions you ask I can't answer. But if Gene, if somebody would get the questions to me and email them to me, I could get them to the experts.
That's a great idea. We'll do that. So think about it, get your questions ready, and we'll work through Gene to get you some answers. Again, thank you very much, Christopher.
Thank you.
For this great presentation. A couple more quick announcements before we go to our next speaker. Remember that tonight we have the President's Dinner. For those of you who are either nominees for office or you are thinking of running from the floor, you should be at the head table. There will be a long head table. And to sit up there with me, and I get the pleasure of just listening to questions, and you get the pleasure of answering them. So that'll be fun. Yes, we get to hear from our candidates. And so please be at the head table if you have been nominated or think you're going to run. Okay. All right. I think we're going to move on to our next speakers, Abigail and Celia. Are you up here? Okay. Why don't you go ahead and come on up? Get you up here, and then I'll introduce you both. Yeah, we can get you. Sit down, and we'll make it happen. Okay, so this is, you know, we are an advocacy organization, so we can't possibly have enough speakers to tell us about successful advocacy stories. And today we really have one. Abigail Tamara, who is from our Silicon Valley chapter and who is an MAMSW, and Celia McGinnis, who's an attorney. She's a managing attorney of the law offices of Paul L. Rain in Oakland, are going to tell you how they teamed up in an awesome success story of self-advocacy. So, without further ado, because I'd rather let them tell the story than, you know, describe what's in the program already, good. Let's hear from Celia and Abigail. Ladies?
Thank you very much. We're thrilled to be invited to be here and to speak to you today. And before we tell you a little bit about ourselves, first I'd kind of like to get a sense of a little bit about you. So could you knock on the table if you have experienced discrimination, been denied access either for a service dog or some other adaptation you needed to have full access? All right. Now, knock on the table if you advocated for yourself and resolved that situation to your satisfaction. All right.
Oh, wonderful.
So we have a great group of self-advocates already. We are going to talk to you a little bit about what worked for us. So as an introduction, do you want to start, Abby, and introduce yourself?
Sure. So I'm Abby Tamara. I have three disabilities. I have macular degeneration, and I'm getting injections in one of my eyes. And I have a bipolar disorder that's characterized by very intense feelings and mood swings. And I also have a back condition. I've had multiple surgeries. And I have my service dog, Inglis, for my back condition, because prior to getting him, I used a walker to get around. He has a rather substantial leather harness, different from the guide dog harnesses. And it was designed by a dog chiropractor for this particular organization, which is Canine Partners for Life in Pennsylvania. And as part of my training with them, access denial was a very strong component. And if somebody came late to training, they had to practice it to be able to continue training and get their dog. They were very serious about it and made a huge impression on my mind. Where are we going now? So at the moment, what I do, I represent consumers for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the Santa Clara County affiliate, and chair their Consumer Advisory Council, provide programming that our council thinks will be helpful for individuals. I belong to a Yahoo group of everybody that's received a service dog from my organization, and we share problems, tips, how to deal with whatever we come across, because we do have, you know, assistance animals. And just to give you an idea of what my dog does, because the tasks are very different than a guide dog. So besides balance and support, my dog retrieves items. He pays for things, he presses handicap buttons, he carries things, he takes off my jacket, he puts laundry in my laundry basket. He was trained to do light switches, but I don't really have those in my house, so I don't use that. But he does press elevator buttons. So there are lots of things, and the people that were in my training had all different kinds of disabilities. We have seizure alert dogs, heart alert dogs, diabetic alert dogs. There were people that were wheelchair users. There were, all different kinds of disabilities that people were trying to gain greater independence with the use of an assistance animal.
And I am Celia McGinnis. I'm an attorney in Oakland, as you heard, and I've always been a trial lawyer, but I came to the idea of disability advocacy and disability rights because one of my three children, Sophia, was born with a degenerative condition that's similar to muscular dystrophy. And so although she had fairly typical development until she was about age six, after that time, her nerves and muscles just stopped responding. And so she went from a child who could pretty much stand on her own and take some steps and could make some sounds to a quadriplegic. And so it was in the process of being her mom that I got secondhand experience of what it's like to live with disabilities in the United States and started to advocate for her for everything relating to schooling, to have, you know, to attend playgrounds and children's events and, I don't know, Easter egg hunts and Halloween parades, and to use assistive technology. She had cortical vision impairment, so I learned some things about vision as well. And it was through advocating for her that I decided to switch jobs and become a disability rights attorney full time. So I now work at a little firm in Oakland, and we represent only people with disabilities. And we represent them in housing discrimination, employment discrimination, and access discrimination, which I define access as more than just are there stairs there, because of course you have to have stairs to get into the building. But access really for me means being able to be fully integrated into whatever you find in that building. And so it's policy access as well as physical access. So I firmly believe that disability rights are civil rights. And you cannot have a civil society, a free society, unless all people are welcome, not just given access, but welcomed and integrated into the community. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk to you a little bit about some ways to advocate for yourself without a lawyer and with a lawyer. But, and I think everybody in this room probably understands the framework of laws that protect you as a person with disabilities. There's both the ADA, which is only 25 years old, and then there are California laws that go back much farther than that. And I think it's important as we talk about advocacy to remember that the ADA, the UNRU Act, the Disabled Persons Act, none of those just sprang forward out of the foreheads of legislators. They all happened because of advocacy by people with disabilities. And we need to go, I think, all the way back to 1974 when people with disabilities occupied the health, education, and welfare offices in San Francisco, D.C., Philadelphia, and across the country. And in San Francisco, for almost a month, they occupied those offices until Joe Califano agreed to sign the first set of regulations that went with the Rehab Act of 1973. So advocacy is a long-honored tradition in the disability community. We're just going to talk to you a little bit about our small piece of it.
So do you want to talk about your philosophy?
Oh, okay. So I have learned that you really have to speak up for yourself and to ask for what you want. And that the more you do that, the easier it gets. Whether that means talking to your medical providers, to agencies that provide you different services, the utilities, whatever it is. And I found that I will start with the regular worker, ask for a supervisor, and go as far up as I need to go to get what I want. I've gone to the president's office of organizations. I've been involved in appeals units, in whatever I can do to get the desired amount effect. And I found that, you know, a lot of times when companies charge you for something because it's something they've done, you find out about it, that if you tell them that this was unjust, they not only will take away the cost, they will try to make it up to you for what they did wrong. So I've always found that it's very useful to do whatever I can, and I do a tremendous amount of research to find out what maybe others have done. If it's a company, I might go to the Better Business Bureau, find out what comments have been made about the company. You know, there is so much that you can do. Let me see. I guess that's where I'm going to stop.
Can you talk about long-range appointments?
Oh, sure. So I belong to a clinic that has multiple offices, and if I call up and ask to have a health provider see me and the appointment is a month away or whatever, I will see who there is at their different offices and see if I can get an appointment sooner. I've been able to get appointments the same day by doing that. And, you know, all medical clinics don't have multiple offices, but it's just one thing that I've learned, that there are all kinds of ways that you can get what you want if you just research it and ask for it.
So naturally, everyone is an advocate in little ways and big ways every day in their lives. But Abby and I came together because Abby came to the point of needing to go beyond self-advocacy and seek redress in the courts. And I want to just give you a brief overview of the two lawsuits that we've been involved in, then have Abby talk about her pre-litigation efforts with Stanford, and then we'll talk about the lawsuit itself. So the first time I met Abby was because she had been hospitalized at El Camino Hospital on the peninsula near San Francisco. She had gone in through the emergency room with her service dog and had no problems in the ER, but when it came time for her to get a room, she was told that she could not have the dog go with her. Because it was her pain management, it was a pain management issue, but because the pain sometimes related to her psychiatric drugs, they decided to admit her into the psychiatric ward instead of into the general ward. Now, 4 days later, they transferred her to the general ward. But at the outset, they said, you can't have a service dog in a psychiatric ward because we don't know how any of the other patients are going to react. So that was, Abby did her best to advocate for herself while hospitalized, but wasn't able to change their minds. And she came to me after she was released from the hospital, and then we filed a lawsuit because we needed to make sure that El Camino changed its policy to ensure that service animals would be allowed to go with patients into the hospital wherever the patient went. The second lawsuit was against Stanford Medical Center, and in this instance, Abby knew that she had to have back surgery, and so she called 2 weeks in advance of her surgery to say, by the way, I'm bringing my dog. Is there anything that, you know, you need to know from me before I bring my dog in? And I'll let her explain her efforts for you, but the bottom line is that she didn't get satisfaction. Then I stepped in and I tried to get them to change their policy in advance of the surgery, but their bottom line policy was, we're not going to allow you to have your dog. You need to have, if you want to have your dog, you need to have an able-bodied handler with you at all times. You need to pay extra for a private room. And if you don't want to pay extra for a private room, we'll put you in a room with a roommate. But if your roommate doesn't like the dog, we're going to evict the dog. So that was the policy that Stanford had at that time. And despite all our pre-litigation efforts, we ended up having to sue. But I think the process of how Abby advocated for herself, both while hospitalized at El Camino the first time and then before her hospitalization at Stanford, is really important to see the kinds of efforts she made. So I think she should talk about that.
Okay, so with El Camino Hospital, I went to, on the psychiatric ward, and as soon as I saw my psychiatrist, I got her to write a doctor's order allowing my dog. She came back to me the next day and said, no, the higher-ups at the hospital have said no, you can't have your dog. And then they said I had to go through infection control, that the dog had to be tested for MRSA, which is a staph infection. And so the person that had my dog, I had them take my dog to the vet. However, the vet, even though it had the latest up-to-date diagnostic tools, had to send the test out because it's a very rare performed test with a 10-day turnaround. The next thing I did was this Yahoo group I mentioned I belonged to. I did have computer access. I went online and detailed, as things were happening, what they were so that I had a written record of events, which was very important when it went to litigation. The next thing I did was ask to meet with the clinical manager of the psychiatric unit. And that person's, and I had to chase that person down before he would meet with me. And when we met, he wanted to transfer me to another hospital that would allow service animals. So in my lawsuit, we sued El Camino Hospital and the clinical manager. At that point, with the 10-day turnaround for the MRSA test and them repeatedly saying no, there were no other options I had. So I spent 13 days in the hospital without my dog. The second lawsuit, which was Stanford, you know, I didn't want to have the same thing happen again. So what I did was I contacted Guest Services 3 times. I was passed to IT, financial services, and the administrative office, and the surgical admission unit also. They told me that no, service dogs were not allowed, and that if you showed up with a dog without somebody with you, they would send the dog to a shelter. So then I spoke again with risk management with a conference call to Guest Services. They were going to call me back and tell me their response, which they did. And at that point, when it was no, I contacted Celia to get involved.
So when Abby contacted me about the El Camino matter, she had been released from the hospital. She'd been deprived of her service dog for 13 days. And we decided that since she had tried so hard to advocate for herself while in the hospital and they had said no, we would just go ahead and file a lawsuit. And so we filed a lawsuit with the primary goal of seeking an injunction to order El Camino Hospital to change its service dog policy. The benefit of this lawsuit was not just to benefit Abby and compensate her for the time she'd been deprived of her dog, but it was to make sure that if Abby went back to this hospital or another person with a service dog went back to the hospital, it wouldn't happen to them too. And that's one of the best tools that the ADA and California law provide for people, is they can ensure that they can solve a problem not just for themselves, but for everybody that comes after them. So we brought the lawsuit and said, El Camino Hospital violated the law because it deprived her of her service dog. It has a blanket policy excluding dogs when the law requires you to allow a dog unless there's actual evidence that there's a direct threat posed by that animal. But El Camino Hospital didn't even offer to meet the dog. El Camino just said, no, we don't allow dogs. So we spent a lot of time actually trying to settle that case. And as time passed and we were negotiating with the defendants, it became apparent that Abby might have to go back into the hospital. And so at that point, I felt like we couldn't wait any longer. And so I brought a motion for a preliminary injunction, which said to the court, Look, we haven't really, you haven't decided this case, you haven't ruled in our favor, but we want you to order the El Camino to change its policies right now. And in order to win that kind of motion, you have to prove you're likely to prevail and that the plaintiff is facing imminent harm. So that was the evidence we brought. We had an expert who talked about hospital administration who said, look, you know, every person who goes into a hospital has a patient plan, and the protocols of the hospital are modified to accommodate what that patient needs. There's no reason that the hospital cannot create a patient plan that allows for a service dog. And the hospital said, well, what if other people are afraid of the dog? What if somebody wrestles the dog's harness off and tries to use it as a weapon? And the response to that was, you know, well, you took her service dog away from her and you gave her a walker. What do you think is a more likely weapon, a harness that's tied to the dog or a walker that you can yank from her grip? I mean, really. And so in the end, the judge ruled that, yes, we were likely to prevail because Abby had a right to have her service dog there unless there was evidence of a direct threat. And there was no evidence. Abby has a really well-trained dog. And the judge further found that it's the hospital's obligation, it's part of what they do, to modify their policies and protocols to enable a person to have the independence to which she is entitled. And the judge said to them, you have to create a lawful service animal policy and you have to implement it within 30 days. And they did. And they did.
Do you want to say anything about the accessibility rooms? Yeah.
So Abby just reminded me that because when we originally filed this lawsuit, we only filed it for the policy violation. But what happened to Abby is when they transferred her from the psych ward to the general ward, in all the rooms she was in, they were not physically accessible for people with mobility disabilities. And with her walker, she had a very hard time using the restroom, using any of the facilities, and found it extremely difficult and exhausting, and so ended up spending more time in bed than she would have been done had she had her dog and had she had physical access. So I said to them, we're just going to go ahead and expand this lawsuit, and we're going to sue you for all the physical access violations you have in the psychiatric ward and in the general ward. So as part of the resolution of the lawsuit, once we got the policy change, we also got a consent decree that ordered El Camino Hospital to make its hospital rooms accessible for people with disabilities. And
Stanford.
Yeah, and so Abby and I really loved working together. I was so pleased to be able to help her make this change, that when she called me and said, you know, I have this surgery coming up at Stanford, and I've been trying to get access for Inglis, and they won't listen to me, I said, no problem. I just got a ruling from El Camino Hospital. I will send their lawyer a letter and say, here's the order I just got from this judge in El Camino Hospital. And I wrote them a letter that said, literally, you folks are about to make a mistake, and I really want to prevent you from making this mistake. So will you please review this order that just came down less than a year ago, and please change your policy to allow service dogs? And so I had these conversations with a lawyer, and we exchanged lawyer letters and for 3 days. And ultimately they said, no, we're sticking with our policy. The lawyer said to me, I'm afraid the dog might urinate in the hallway. I'm afraid the dog will get in the way of the nurses. I'm afraid the dog will jump up on her bed and hurt her. And I said, you know, respectfully, it's clear that you don't know anything about service animals. And really, Abby's surgery is coming up, so we don't really have time to educate you. I'm just going to point you to the law. You have to let the dog in. And they said no. So, go ahead.
So we sued Stanford Board of...
Well, the Board of Governors, you know, the official names. But okay. We basically sued the medical center. The interesting thing was that Abby was in the hospital for 3 days at Stanford and then was transferred to a rehab hospital. And originally, the rehab hospital had kind of been leery of having a dog, but I picked up the phone and called them, and they said, oh, okay, thanks for the education. And when Abby went to the rehab hospital, there was no problem. She had full access for her dog. But Stanford would not do it.
And actually, another thing I did when I was in rehab was had pictures taken of the way that I positioned my dog's bed, how I tethered him so that he was, and how he was positioned away from the door so that when nurses come in, he wasn't right in their way. I had pictures of me in physical rehab with him walking in the hall. So I have documentation. And I think documentation is extremely important. Another thing just to mention, with El Camino Hospital, the discrimination lasted 13 days of the hospitalization. With Stanford, although the hospitalization was only 3 days, the discrimination began from my first telephone call until I got out of the hospital. So although it was only 3 days, it was a much lengthier time period. And those facts are very important in litigation. Because they make the whole picture of what really went on.
When we filed the first document in the lawsuit, which is called the complaint, we actually put photographs of Abby and Inglis into the complaint so that the judge or anyone reading it would be able to see, here's Inglis with his harness, his vest saying, I'm a working dog, and you know, this is the menace that the hospital was facing. Abby is absolutely right. Abby had great notes of whom she called and when. I had the letters in the second case, but in the first case, she also had the note from her doctor, and she had and very clear notes, and she had also given El Camino Hospital a lot of information that by law you're not really obligated to give, but she had given them her vet records. She had given them a document showing her rights as a service dog user. She had really done her
the
best
law,
to educate.
The certification. In fact, my dog's harness has backpacks on both sides of it. I carry the law book that delineates the law as well as state by state the law. I carry emergency instructions, his rabies vaccinations, his certification when we graduated as a team, which he also has a tag. I go through certification every 2 years, and I have a tag on the back of his harness that has a picture of us with the signed certification. Let me see, there was one other thing I wanted to say. Once Celia said that in the lawsuit we sent pictures of Inglis. It wasn't until El Camino saw those pictures that they had ever laid eyes on Inglis, and it was at that point that their information about what his harness could or couldn't do was derived. But also, once the lawsuit was filed, they made a policy in the hospital that no service dogs would ever be allowed on the psychiatric unit, which, of course, once the lawsuit finished, had to be changed.
So with Stanford, the case isn't entirely wrapped up, but we can say that Stanford has now changed its policy and will be putting its new policy, making its new policy available on the website in accessible format, and will be training its staff. So our lesson here is that there's a lot you can do for yourself. But there are some times when you just need to bring in the law, and that's, of course, what the system's set up for. That's why we have these rules. The benefit of it is when the ADA was enacted and when California law was enacted before then, the government decided that rather than set up a bureaucracy, a separate bureaucracy with government lawyers that would do the enforcement, it made these statutes into what are called private attorney general lawsuits. So that if a person, a plaintiff, brings a lawsuit on her own behalf and succeeds, the defendant has to pay her attorney's fees. So the wrongdoer pays. And the benefit of that is that folks who don't have a lot of financial resources can afford to hire an attorney to go ahead and advocate for them, and I can afford to have a law firm because I know I will get paid in the end if I just succeed. So that, I think, I would hope sort of would relieve a lot of people's fears about whether or not it's possible to file a lawsuit, because it really is. And we'd like to take a couple minutes and talk about what it's like to have a lawsuit. From the perspective of the plaintiffs, a lot more than the lawyer, but I'm going to start just to give you an overview of what a lawsuit looks like. The first document you file is the complaint, which says, here's what they did wrong. And then they have to answer. And then in some courts, they send you to a mediation process right away and try and get the case settled at an early date. If that doesn't work, then there's a process of what's called discovery, where this is the stuff that you see on TV of depositions and document production and collecting all the facts. And then there's another chance to settle the case usually. And then oftentimes there's a motion to see if the judge can make a ruling as a matter of law because everyone agrees on the facts. And if that doesn't work, then there can be a trial. That process is long. and it takes a lot of patience. And so what I'd like is to just talk a little bit about what it feels like to be a plaintiff when you're in a lawsuit and you're not in charge of what's going on, and how Abby managed it.
So the El Camino lawsuit lasted 2.5 years. We went through 3 mediations in 2 different locations, day-long mediations each time, and they all required me to spend the night, and in a couple of cases, 2 nights, because of traffic patterns, where they were located. But it is a very long process. Patience, patience, patience. And as I told you, I have a bipolar disorder. And so the stress level, you know, can be very, you know, extreme. But to me, the importance of what it was that we were doing far outweighed what I had to go through at the time to get through it. And my, you know, I suggest tremendous support from the people, you know, that you care about and that you're close to. I found also that being very active in the process, in other words, what information did I have that could help Celia? What kinds of things could I think through that she may not be aware of? What could I do? If she asked for information, I tried to get it to her immediately because I know that, you know, between lawyers going back and forth to each other, the process is just so long, and I wanted to do everything I could to alleviate any extra time. You know, I know that she has a busy schedule. I'm certainly not her only case. And that, you know, I wanted to facilitate in whatever way I could. So being very proactive is extremely important. As I said, I also went on my Yahoo group to get information. Has anybody else experienced access denial at hospitals? Has anybody else been hospitalized? Please tell me the name of the hospital and your experience. What part of the country? You know, I did as much legwork as I could to get any information that might be helpful. Let me see. And another thing, since there's a lot of lag time, I wanted to make sure that I knew what was going on. So any questions I had, I wanted to get answered so that I wasn't thinking, oh, what's happening? You know, is this going to, you know, I wanted to have accurate information to alleviate my stress. And so I was very proactive in that way. I think I talked to your office manager, your assistants, you know, anybody that could help me, you know, say what was going on so I, you know, could alleviate my fears. You know, the other side is always going to look for ways that they can tear down whatever your argument is. And you have to be very strong and withstand that and think, you know, this is important what I'm doing. It's important for me and it's important for everybody else that's going to come after me. And those are the things that got me through it.
So as a lawyer, I really appreciated how quickly Abby was able to respond to me when I had questions. And I also appreciated the fact that she would call me up and say, you know, I haven't heard from you in a while. What's going on? Because every lawyer wants to do the best for her client, but we can get distracted, and sometimes we get distracted with the legal issues and we forget about the human factor. So I was always grateful to receive a phone call. And the folks in my office also, anybody who answers the phone will do what they can to help our clients when we call up, when they call up. As lawyers, you know, unfortunately most lawyers who do this work do not have disabilities. And so I know that when I approach a case with a person with a disability, even with my own experience, I may be working from a point of profound ignorance. And certainly I have stepped in it myself quite a number of times as regards disability culture and just simple day-to-day things. And so I find that it's really important for me. I have to ask questions that normally people don't ask each other about, I don't know, how do you toilet and those sorts of things. It's kind of awkward to ask sometimes, but what I really appreciate is when I do make a mistake, my client says to me, you know, that's not really how my life looks. This is how my life looks from my perspective, and this is what you need to know. Because having that information makes me a better advocate. So I need to know things that I'm not even, didn't even know that I needed to know. And so I always appreciate it when my client is willing to sit down and be very candid with me from the first. Sometimes it takes a while to develop a relationship of trust, but it's important to get there, and it's important to spend enough time together so that you get to have a personal relationship as well as a legal relationship. I forgot to mention, and Abby's urging me to mention the fact that I sit on the California Commission for Disability Access, and the State Senate has just confirmed me to a second term. thank you. And I don't want to digress too far, but the CCDA, the purpose is to ensure access for people with disabilities, mostly physical access, by educating business about how they can make their businesses more accessible.
And I just want to add that I have listened in to the meetings. They are available, accessible for individuals, and there is also time for input by individuals, and I have spoken out, and I urge anybody else interested to get involved also.
So that's our story, and we wanted to leave enough time for people to ask questions, either about what happened to us or about something else you might have a question about on any of the topics we touched on.
These are dots that you put on, like, temperatures on ovens and things so you know where to go.
Oh, interesting. That's cool.
I'm particularly interested in hearing about the situation in the hospital. In my former position as ADA compliance officer for the city of LA, I had a call from a woman who was incarcerated overnight and wanted to and complained because they wouldn't let her service dog in the holding cell with her. So I'm interested in how you addressed, if you had to address it, the issue of assuming you were not permitted out of the ward, how you would take the dog out and how you would feed the dog or whether someone else would be responsible. How did you deal with that issue if you had to?
So first of all, if you don't have family members to come in and take the dog out, and I did it three times a day, you hire a dog walking service that comes in, takes the dog out, you give instructions, and brings the dog back. I have food in certain places that I'd have people bring to me in a container. Actually, at El Camino Hospital, they have an outdoor fenced-in area that people that have privileges can walk in, so that would have been an easy, accessible issue. But people just have people come in and take the dog out and bring the dog back. The law is that unless it's an operating room, burn unit, or immunosuppressant area, the dog has access. Unless the dog is inappropriate, is aggressive, soils, whatever. But you know, I never rely on any staff. It's always who I hire or friends or whatever to come in and take the dog out.
And from a legal perspective, the statute, the root law, says that hospitals and other government entities and other businesses shall modify their policies. So a part of it is looking at the situation you're in and seeing how access can be ensured in the physical, the geographic location where you are. So as Abby mentioned, this psychiatric ward had an enclosed courtyard. There was no need for Abby to leave the ward in order to toilet her dog. At the hospital, if she wasn't physically able to go outside, she was able to hire someone else to do it or have friends come in. On the question of a service dog in a holding cell, that is a very unique situation, which I'd love to talk to you about. It might... Okay, I'd love to hear it, because there's only two exceptions to access for a service dog. And one is that the dog presents a direct threat, which has to be actual evidence that there's a threat. Like, you can't have a dog in a burn ward because there's just too much chance of infection. Or you actually see this dog misbehave. It has to be evidence, not fear or speculation. And the other exception is if the presence of the dog would fundamentally alter the nature of the service. So dogs are not allowed in zoos and safari parks. That's just sort of because it's just incompatible with a safe atmosphere for the other animals. Not that the dog would misbehave, but the animals
would. Is it California? Because yeah. My dog was at the zoo. We trained at the zoo.
Well, if your dog has been allowed into the zoo, don't tell them.
Don't say anything.
Don't say anything. But it's actually so. What I'm trying to point out is if somehow the presence of the dog itself fundamentally alters the nature of the service, I think the jail might have an argument about that. but you know, it's certainly worth advocating to see what's possible, and you may not get the whole loaf. I mean, that's one thing. There are very few lawsuits that are as stunningly successful as the ones Abby and I have had, but it's always worth trying, and at least you can get some improvement if you can't get what you've ideally like.
Now, my organization in Pennsylvania uses puppy raising programs in a number of prisons in Pennsylvania and Maryland. And they feel that the inmates benefit from having dogs assigned to them to train.
Stop. Dead again. I'm alive. We're going to have to call time because we're going to be running behind schedule if we don't, and we have a very important other speaker. But I want to thank both of you ladies for an excellent tag team presentation. We love to hear stories like that, and there's so much positive to learn what Celia and Abby did.
And I just want to add, I am going to be here until tomorrow, so if you see me around, I'm happy to talk to anybody else. Or, I'm sorry.
Great. Thank you again.
So, Celia, you'll have to say, this is Celia.
I'll make myself known to folks.
Okay, so, I'm sorry, what was that?
Contact information.
Yeah. Contact information for Celia?
Yeah.
Okay. Celia's contact.
So I can give you right now, and then I can go to the back of the room and hand out business cards, but I'll give it to you right now, my cell phone number so that you can reach me while I'm here. And it's 510-388-7532. And you can use that to call me now or at any time. And also, the name of my law firm is in the program, and it's the Law Office of Paul Ryan in Oakland. So, or you can Google me, and I'm happy to talk to anyone.
All right. Thank you very much, both of you. Okay, we're going to have two quick announcements before we go on to our next speaker. I'm going to make the first one, and that is that, as you know, our first item of business at this evening's session is always remembrances of people who have passed since the last convention. And the reason I want to underscore that is that at the end of that particular item, we will do a special tribute to Winifred Downing, and I would ask those who have remembrances of her to get them ready for us so that we can all remember her well this evening. Okay, Pam Pology has a lost and found announcement, I believe.
Is it on?
I didn't turn it on.
I don't know.
How did we turn the mic on, Jeff?
Mic is not on.
Now it is, I think. Thank you. I just wanted to let everyone know, and I don't know if these two women are in here or not, but if they're not, please pass the word to Artis Bazin and to Esperanza Gaze. I picked up some paperwork for both of you that was in the room last night from the nominating and from credentials, and so I took it to registration so that it's there safe. I know that when I got to registration, they said you guys have been looking for it. So if you get there today before 5 or tomorrow during the day, it's there for you, and I thank you.
Thank you. Okay, our last speakers for the day. We turn from self-advocates or advocacy to a similarly serious topic for our community, and that is services for victims of crime. How many of you have been a victim of crime at some point in your life? Nobody? Well, a few people.
Yes.
I have been. Yes. See, quite a few. Well, we have two speakers with us today. Linda Pena, who is Victim Assistance Program Manager for the District Attorney's Office in San Diego County, and Desmond Townsend, who's a supervising paralegal with the San Diego District Attorney's Office. Desmond Townsend, who is supervising paralegal with the San Diego District Attorney's Office. And they are going to tell us today about services available to victims of crime, both in San Diego and a little bit on a broader focus as well. So Linda and Desmond, take it away. Thank you very much.
Thank you so very much.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to speak with you this afternoon about the Victim Assistance Program. I'm going to give you a little information about our program and talk about the services that we offer, and then I'll turn it over to Desmond, who's going to give you great information about the State Victim Compensation Program. So the Victim Assistance Program is a staff of 21 victim advocates and supervisors, and we work with victims of crime throughout the County of San Diego. The California Penal Code actually mandates that certain services be provided to victims of crime throughout the state. So if you don't live here in San Diego and live elsewhere in California, I guarantee you there is a program in your county. We assist victims of all types of crime, whether or not a suspect is apprehended, because sometimes people have the misconception that charges need to be filed before we can get involved and provide assistance, and that's just not the case. The type of assistance we're able to provide to a victim will depend on the crime type and the circumstances involved. But we are there to assist everybody. We have advocates in San Diego located all around the county in all of the various courthouses and at the Hall of Justice. At the Hall of Justice, we have advocates who specialize in elder and dependent adult abuse cases, child abuse, sex crimes and human trafficking, and domestic violence cases. Now, we define a victim as anyone who's emotionally, physically, or financially affected by a crime, and that can encompass a lot of people when a crime occurs, and we are there to provide assistance to everyone. To give you an idea of the magnitude of the work we have here in San Diego, I want to share a few statistics with you. For our last fiscal year, 2014-2015, we provided assistance to 14,053 victims. That's a lot of people in San Diego County that are affected by crime. Of those, we assisted 646 homicide survivors, 6,700 domestic violence victims, and that is by far the biggest crime category that we see, it's domestic violence, 2,027 assault victims. Of the services that we provided almost 14,000 referrals to various community agencies, and we assisted with 2,687 applications to the victim compensation that Desmond's going to speak about. So you may wonder, how do we come into contact with victims? How do we find out about them? Well, one thing we do is we monitor the media. When I began working for the DA's office in 1995, we had no internet access. We used to read the newspaper every day. Fortunately, that's changed now. We get up-to-the-minute news, and we are looking for homicide cases that occur. So those are our highest priority. When a homicide occurs, we immediately contact the detective to find out the circumstances and then make contact with the family, because we want to provide them with information that can perhaps assist them with making decisions about how they're going to handle things moving forward. But the biggest method by learning about victims is through police reports. In San Diego, we're extremely fortunate that we have a great working relationship with all of the law enforcement agencies. So we get copies of police reports every day, and we're screening them, looking for victims who are possibly eligible to services, and then we make contact with them. With the volume we have, it's impossible to call everyone, so we have our priorities, our elder abuse, dependent adults, we want to try to make contact by phone, cases where victims are seriously injured, child abuse cases, serious domestic violence cases, sexual assault cases, and then we send letters to everyone else. We also work closely with law enforcement. We provide training to them when they are at the police academy at the very beginning of their career. And we also continue to follow up with training at the various law enforcement agencies so that they can contact us when they're working with a victim who needs assistance. Also, with the many community agencies that are located in San Diego County, we cross-train with them, and there's a lot of communication regarding clients who are victims and how we could possibly assist them. I want to let you know that assisting victims of crime is our passion, and we want to help everyone to the extent that help is available. What do we do with victims when we talk to them? Well, one thing, we do a lot of crisis intervention. When a crime occurs, that something totally unexpected happens and is very traumatic, and it's understandable that victims are in a state of crisis. They don't know what to do next. So we'll do a needs assessment with them, determine what their needs are, whether they need food, medical treatment, clothing, shelter. We problem solve with them to determine what resources they have, and then we refer them to the many agencies in San Diego County for assistance. That's one of our functions, is to match them up with the services that they need. Now, if we have a domestic violence victim who needs to get into emergency shelter, we do make calls to try to arrange something for them, but we connect them with community resources. In some instances, we also accompany them to an interview with either law enforcement or the prosecutor, depending upon the circumstances of the crime. Now, we have initial contact with victims, and in the majority of cases, it does not end there. I personally have contact with victims sometimes for years after the crime has happened. Depends on the type of case and what their needs are. And we are always there to provide assistance to them. We can provide case status. If a person has been the victim of a crime and the case is going to court, there are a lot of questions about the criminal justice process, what is the next hearing, what's going to happen. And a lot of times we can really allay a person's fears and concerns because we're providing them with that knowledge that they need in order to get through that process. The orientation to the criminal justice system is very important because most people, they've never been involved in the process before, and their idea of what happens in a court case is what they get from TV or on the media. And things don't work exactly that way. So we provide them with that information. We also provide crime prevention information when someone's been the victim of a crime. Maybe there are some things they haven't thought about security-wise or the way they're doing things, and we can provide them with some information to help prevent a crime occurring again. We also assist with property return. When a crime occurs, a lot of times the police take property that's involved in the crime, and when the case is over, the question comes up of how do we get that back? And we're happy to help with that. We also talk to victims about restitution. If you are the victim of a crime and you have any out-of-pocket expenses or losses as a result, you are entitled to an order of restitution. That's when a judge will order a defendant to pay you for those losses. And we work with victims to help them gather information, explain the process, and again, we are there down the road if they're not getting any money collected, and we can put them in touch with the right people to look into that for them. We also provide court services, and that we will go to court with victims of crime. Again, most people have never been involved in the process. They've never been to court before. It's very intimidating for them. And imagine you've been the victim of a crime, and now you're going to be sitting in the same room with the person who has assaulted you. It can be very scary. So to have somebody who fully understands the process, knows the courtroom etiquette and can explain it, to be there as a comfort can go a long way in helping a person feel calmer and more comfortable about going into that testimony, into that courtroom. We'll liaison with the prosecutor if necessary. And we also talk to victims about victim impact statements. When a person has been the victim of a crime and we have a defendant who is convicted or pleads guilty, the victim has a right to make a victim impact statement at sentencing to let the court and the defendant know how the crime has affected them. And that is a very important right that victims have here in California, especially because it's the only time to talk about how the crime has affected them. And it forces the defendant to hear the effect their actions have had on this individual or on this family. Another thing we do is we are very concerned about victims being aware of their rights. Now, in 2008, a victim's bill of rights known as Marcy's Law was passed by the voters in California and added to the Constitution. And it details 17 rights that are now provided to victims of crime, which gives them a greater right to participation in the criminal justice system. This is huge. Years ago, when a person was the victim of a crime, once the report was filed and we had a case issued, the victim became a witness and nobody really paid any attention to them and their needs. Now they have rights, and we urge everybody to become familiar with them and to exercise them. Among the highlights, victims have a right to be treated with fairness and respect. They have a right to speak at all court proceedings. They can argue or speak to the judge regarding increasing bail. They have the right to be notified of anything going on with the case if they request it. And they have a right to restitution. And they have a right to provide information to a probation officer regarding a pre-sentence report. And their rights continue after a defendant has been sentenced. They go to prison. They even have a right to provide input into any parole conditions if that person's going to be released. So we've certainly come a long way in California as far as victims' rights are concerned over the last 25 years or so. I'm now going to turn the presentation over to Desmond, who will speak with you regarding the victim compensation program. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Linda. Thanks so much, Linda. Hope I have this mic right. As Linda mentioned, my name is Desmond Townsend. I work with the San Diego District Attorney's Office, and we employ, of course, several employees, but for the most part, we have a contract between the state of California and the city and county of San Diego to process victim compensation applications for people who have been victimized by perpetrators in San Diego County. Now, some might think that we have a lot of people doing the job, but we only have about 5 people working the entire county of San Diego. We have advocates stationed throughout the city in North County, East County, and I'm not certain if you're familiarized with San Diego, but it's a pretty big area to cover. But those specialists do a great job of processing these cases and try and get them done within 90 working days. For the most part, our funding comes from the State Victim Compensation Program, but where they get their funding is from actually restitution monies. A lot of people feel that, you know, I pay my taxes, I was a victim, you need to help me out. But they forget that a lot of the money that we receive do not come from taxpayers' money. It comes from the defendants or anyone that may have made an infraction, such as paying a parking ticket. Those money go into a large restitution fund that also pays for police uniforms and vehicles and things of that nature. For the most part, we take a chunk of that money and pay victims of violent crimes for their losses related to a violent crime. Now, we also receive funding from the National Victim Compensation Fund. And the good thing about that is we're designed that if we spend more money to compensate victims of violent crime, we will receive more funding from these actual organizations. So in essence, the more we spend, the more we can actually provide services to other victims, which is a good thing in a nutshell, though. Some of the covered crimes that we pay for, and have to keep in mind that you have to keep in mind that it's victims of violent crime. Property crimes are not something that's normally covered by our program. But we do pay for assault, burglary, child abuse, domestic violence, anything related to domestic violence, whether it be a sexual assault case, and well, we can actually do coverage for them as well. We pay for homicide victims and their families, pay for the funeral and burial costs associated with that homicide. And we're also paying human trafficking. I'm not really certain if you're familiarized with that, but that's becoming pretty popular, especially around the border town. So we're one of those border towns, and human trafficking is pretty big here, getting bigger. We're trying to put some resources in place to actually help these victims, support them emotionally as well as physically. We pay for kidnapping, online harassment, which is something that's very, very new. No one knew how a person would feel being victimized by a perpetrator harassing them on the internet, providing photos of them in compromising situations. Well, those type of crimes are now covered by our program, and that wasn't always the case. We also pay for military sexual assault, which is not something we always had as well. Terrorism, vehicle-related expenses, or should I say vehicle-related crimes, as well as mass violence. You've heard about the San Bernardino incident where we have active shooters. Well, we're designed to actually help out the families as well as the co-workers, help them out financially with their mental health counseling as well as their medical needs as well. I'm going to go over a little bit about defining a victim. A lot of people don't understand our lingo, and I try and keep it as clear from a lot of acronyms. But for the most part, a victim is defined to us as one who sustains injury, threat of injury, or death. We also have other family members that are qualified for the program. Their whole purpose is designed to actually support the victim and their families. And they can also be traumatized by the events leading up to the crime as well. But we have parents, children, spouse, sibling, registered domestic partners, grandparents, grandchildren. Uncles and aunts are not qualified for the program unless they lived in the same house at the time of the crime or at some point in time there, 2 years or more. It doesn't even have to be consecutive. As long as they live with the victim for a period of 2 years or more, then they too can actually be qualified. But extended families are not usually qualified for the victims for the program. But grandparents is a new thing that's come out. It's one that we've fought for years to get past, and grandchildren and grandparents are now covered by the program, which is a good thing. That wasn't always the case. We do have some residential requirements. At the time of the crime, the victim must be a California resident. If they're not a California residency, that's not an issue. Take, for instance, if you go out to a different state and you're victimized there, you, as a California resident, can also qualify for benefits through this program, provided that that state doesn't have a program to cover you. And if they don't, no problem. You're covered because you're a California resident. Take, for instance, if you're on vacation. You're on vacation in San Diego, and you're injured here. Well, you're not a California resident, but because you were injured here, you can actually be covered by our program. That's a good thing for us as well. We do have some filing deadlines. Everyone has to file an application with the program within 3 years. And if they don't, we have some rules that can allow us to go beyond that three-year period. Take, for instance, minors can't always dictate when they can file an application. Parents may not believe what actually happened to them was a crime. Some are just unhelpful. Well, minor victims has up until the age of 18 and 3 years beyond that point to receive coverage through our program. We also have ways of extending that period. Take, for instance, if a body was found maybe 5-10 years later, we could extend that deadline to encompass applications for the victims and their families. So we do try and enhance our benefits a lot more to cover as many victims as we possibly can. Any questions so far? Okay, great. Some of the covered expenses that we cover are crime scene cleanup, medical and dental expenses, mental health charges. We can relocate a victim of a violent crime to a different location, provided that they do not provide the suspect with their new address or information. We provide income and support loss. Support loss is when a family member is deceased and that the victims actually lose that income. So we can utilize their perceived income and try and pay them back what they would have earned had they been alive. We pay for funeral and burial expenses up to $7,500. It used to be $5,000, but we're, again, enhancing our benefits to increase and enhance our benefits to other victims. We pay for vehicle modification, which is some of the only property type expenses that we actually can cover. We also pay for seeing eye glasses, a residential security. We pay for those. That's property, but for the most part, it's mainly medically or mental health related expenses. Linda spoke a little bit about relocation benefits. We can relocate that victim within 30 days. We have an emergency situation where we have local funding in San Diego County where we can actually cut a check to the victims or their landlords to remove them from a dangerous situation, which is a good thing, especially when the perpetrator is getting out of jail or is actually in searching for the victim. The maximum that we can allow is $2,000 for relocation, but we're, again, enhancing our benefits, and we're hoping to increase that to about $4,000 in the near future. We pay for security deposits, travel costs, gas and food, temporary lodging, and also storage fees. And at times, we will have no choice but to deny a case. And in certain situations, a victim must cooperate with law enforcement in order to be covered by our program. They have to be willing to report the incident, be willing to testify in court, and be ready for any of the proceedings and attend all hearings as needed. We do have some mitigating factors that we consider. Give you an example. A person may not want to testify in court because of fear of retaliation or the fact that they'll be losing money from their spouse who was actually the batterer. Well, we can look at that situation and verify, okay, there may be some issues there, and we're going to go ahead and pay the case no matter what, regardless of them cooperating or not. But for the most part, most people have to cooperate with the program and law enforcement in order to receive coverage. There are some participation and involvement issues, and I'll skip onto that, and I'll go into the felon status. A lot of people assume that they can qualify for the program if they're felons, but we've learned over the years that, hey, people may be felons at one point in time but have changed their lives and moved forward and have done nothing since that time. We can pay for those people who are convicted of a felony in the past, depending on the situation. But if they're incarcerated on probation or parole, then we can't do anything as far as benefits are concerned, but we can qualify them for the program. And once they're off probation, parole, or out of jail, then we can consider benefits for them as long as they have new losses related to the qualifying crime. We are a last resort program. We have to check all sources of reimbursement before we can actually make any payment on these cases. Take, for instance, if you're injured and you have medical expenses, we're going to ask that you bill your insurance company for the expenses. And if you have a co-payment, cost share, deductible amount, that's when we can actually step in and make payments on the case. If it's a vehicle-related expense or an accident, we're definitely going to have you file a claim with your victim insurance, your vehicle insurance. If it happened at work, during business hours, workers' compensation is going to be one of the reimbursement sources we're going to check into. If you have public assistance, such as Medi-Cal or Medicare, we're going to be asking for that. If you file a civil suit related to the incident, we're going to try and tap into that as well. And the reason being is we're trying to keep this program solvent for other victims of violent crime. So it may sound like we're being greedy, but our main focus is to make sure that we bring money back into the fund and pay other victims of violent crimes as well. We have a unit designed to actually do just that. It's called the Criminal Restitution Compact Unit. It's another government agency inside our district attorney's office where their main focus is to track defendants through the justice system to ensure that restitution orders and fines are actually assessed during the proceedings. A lot of times people don't know that we have people in court looking at the information provided by the courts, talking to the deputy DAs, letting them know that, hey, this defendant has not paid their restitution. We're really focusing on that. The main reason is to bring money back in the program so we can enhance our benefits. So it's important that we actually do that. So these folks are important to our office. They provide training to the deputy DAs, prosecution side of the house as well, but they also provide information to the defense attorneys, probation officers, about restitution and the victim's rights to restitution. And that's another section where you can actually do the request for property expenses. So if there's a loss that the program cannot pay for, we can actually order the restitution from the defendant during the court's proceedings. There are going to be times when, I'm almost there, almost two more minutes. I got a couple more things to talk about. Take, for instance, if a defendant is incarcerated and owes a victim's money for that. Well, we have a setup with the detention centers to collect 50% of their trust accounts to actually take those monies and pay the victims directly or pay it back into the fund. What happens when they're released? We have other mechanisms in place. Once they're released and off probation, the Franchise Tax Board is an agency that we use to collect monies from those defendants. If the person is on probation, then we collect through the Revenue Recovery Office. And it looks like I'm running out of time, so I'm going to go ahead and stop here. But I really appreciate you inviting us to the convention here, and I hope everyone is having a good time. But if you have any questions, let us know.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm off. We're actually running just about done, so we don't have any time for questions. Hopefully, can you stay up here at the end for a few minutes? And.
Sure.
Debbie, can we pick a quick door prize? What?
Yes.
Okay, we have a speaker and a docking station from the Capitol chapter. And so we're going to, which is a pretty cool thing, that's what I understand. Or so I'm told by someone who knows much better than me, or so she always tells me. I'll hear about that. That's okay. Just take one and let Brooks tell us the magic words. Oh, Louie got a docking station. Oh, man. Did you say you cannot or you can? I bet you can. All right, very good. Okay, we are now officially adjourned until 7 p.m. See you at the president's dinner. Thank you. And all those meetings, go to your meetings. Thank you very much.